Welcome to the Age of Napoleon. As always, I'd like to start by thanking you for your support. I realize putting these statements at the beginning of every episode might make them all blend together and start to seem a bit pro forma, but I really do appreciate the fact that so many of you believe enough in this project to put your money behind it. It's not something I take lightly. You may have noticed this dispatch is a bit late and a bit brief. I got COVID again, so I've been moving a little slowly this month. This has actually been written for a while, but I have asthma and my lung capacity is not great under normal circumstances, so I wanted to give myself a little extra time to heal, so I can bring you a full-length regular episode at the end of the month. Anyway, it's a new year, so I thought we'd start by looking back at 2023. The show was downloaded 3,102,446 times. At the beginning of the year, I thought 3 million downloads would be a good target to shoot for, then did a little back-of-the-envelope math and determined it was pretty unlikely. But we made it anyway, and I want to thank you guys for your help in getting there. In 2022, we only had about 2.3 million downloads, so the show grew by a little more than a third in just 1 year. Some of that is probably due to the movie, but these things really do depend on word of mouth, so thank you to everyone who has helped spread the word. A little over half the listeners come from the USA, with other large English-speaking countries filling up the top four, the UK, Canada, and Australia. The top non-English-speaking country was Germany. In narrative terms, we started the year in the harsh Polish winter of early 1807, covered Eylau, Friedland, and the Treaty of Tilsit, and then ended the year gearing up for the Peninsular War. The first discrete event we covered last year was the entry of Polish troops into Wrocław, Poland, on January 6, 1807. The last event we covered last year was the signing of the Treaty of Fontainebleau between Napoleon and the Sausage Maker on October 27, 1807. That adds up to about 10 months of history, although that's mostly because we took so many digressions after the Treaty of Tilsit. Anyway, I've talked about myself for long enough, so on to your questions. First, Ashley Koch asked, "Do you have any knowledge about queer people and their rights during this period? I know, for instance, that several German states decriminalized same-sex acts around this time, but I am really unaware how these things played out in everyday life." We talked about this a bit in our episodes on the Napoleonic Code, but to recap briefly, there was no mention of homosexuality in Napoleon's new Code of Civil Law, making France one of the only countries in the world where same-sex relationships were legal. This was in keeping with Napoleon's own views on homosexuality, which he saw as nothing more than a harmless personal foible. This wasn't an entirely modern view. For instance, he was known to tease Cambaceres for his preference for other men, which would probably make him a bit of a bully by our standards. Still, this was more or less consistent with Napoleon's views on merit. He generally saw people's personal traits as irrelevant to their deeper characters. He believed in judging people based on their actions. You mentioned many German states decriminalizing same-sex relations during this period. That's the influence of the Napoleonic Code. When France pressured its allies and vassals to adopt French-style laws, that also meant French-style social policy. You asked how this played out in real life. That's an important question. It's always important to keep in mind that social mores don't spring directly from government policy. In fact, it's often the reverse, government policy codifying pre-existing social norms. Western societies of this period had very strong taboos against same-sex relationships. Those taboos didn't vanish overnight when the law changed. In a recent episode, we talked a bit about the personal life of Jean-Jacques Régis de Cambaceres, who lived more or less openly as what we would call a gay man, to the point where British propagandists even made comments about it. There is a great story about this. Apparently Napoleon started to worry that Cambaceres' homosexuality was becoming a liability for the government. Bonaparte didn't care what he did in private, but suggested that he mitigate some of the gossip by bringing female dates to the theater. Cambaceres agreed, but the plan backfired. When he showed up to the theater with a woman on his arm, they immediately became the center of attention, but not in the way Napoleon was hoping. The whole audience found the idea of Cambaceres on a date with a woman so ridiculous that most people in the audience were cracking jokes about the situation instead of watching the play. It's a funny anecdote, but it's important to remember that Cambaceres was an exceptional case. As one of the most powerful and well-connected people on the continent, who enjoyed Napoleon's absolute confidence, Cambaceres had free rein to do what he wanted. Most queer people of this era were not so lucky. The fact that same-sex relations were no longer technically illegal certainly made them safer than they had been before, but safer does not necessarily mean safe. While homosexual acts were no longer illegal, queer people could still be charged with things like public indecency. Given the prevalence of homophobic attitudes, it was pretty easy, and not uncommon, for authorities to twist these laws to target queer people. And there were certainly no legal protections against discrimination. If a person was outed, they could be fired from their job, kicked out of their housing, or expelled from any organization or institution with no legal recourse. There was also the risk of interpersonal retaliation. Of course, not all straight people in this era were committed homophobes. There were plenty of people, like Napoleon, who didn't really care what others did in their personal lives. But the prevailing views of homosexuality were negative. At best, an unnatural vice. At worst, a manifestation of evil. Many people would not countenance a friendship or even a professional relationship with a queer person. Some might even react violently to their very presence. And so, most non-straight people in Napoleonic Europe kept this side of themselves secret. In big cosmopolitan cities, there were public places that were known as hangouts for those interested in meeting other people of the same sex who were interested in meeting other people of the same sex. In Paris, at least, these were generally tolerated by the authorities, although for reasons we've already discussed, actually going to one did carry some risk. As is always the case, the rich and powerful had a much easier time managing this risk. Even the most homophobic Paris guardsmen would have known better than to haul in someone like Cambaceres on an obscenity charge. And as we discussed in our episode on life in Paris, one of the main benefits of wealth in this era was the ability to buy privacy. Average people generally lived in extremely tight quarters. It was quite common to see entire families occupying a single room. It's very hard to carry on a double life with your entire family, and maybe your neighbors too, looking over your shoulder. We talk about these types of relationships as going on behind closed doors, but closed doors would have been an unattainable luxury to many people. With all that said, the social mores of this era did sometimes make it easy for queer people to hide in plain sight. As I mentioned in an early episode, Napoleonic-era European societies were highly segregated by sex. That meant there were a lot of all-male environments and a lot of all-female environments. A man who chose to only spend his time around other men, or a woman who only spent her time around other women, would not raise eyebrows in the same way that it might have in the 20th century. For instance, this is how a lot of people explained away Frederick the Great's homosexuality. Well, he's a man's man. He's only interested in masculine pursuits, so it's quite natural that he would surround himself with men, and even feel uncomfortable in the presence of women. Those in the know probably would have laughed at that, but a lot of average people believed it, and it was actually the consensus among historians in the 19th and early 20th centuries. This was also an era in which friendship was often far more affectionate and intimate than it is today. It was not at all unusual to see two men or two women walking down the street arm in arm or hand in hand. Unmarried people often attended restaurants or parties or theatrical performances with a companion of the same sex. Friends told each other, "I love you," and kissed each other on the face. They threw their arms around each other's shoulders when they were engaged in conversation. Horatio Nelson and his best friend, Cuthbert Collingwood, carried miniature portraits of one another. As young men, Napoleon and General Junot often went on walks together in Paris, hand in hand. From what we know, all four of these men were straight as arrows. In fact, both Napoleon and Nelson were famous for their weaknesses for beautiful women. The fact is, this was entirely normal behavior for straight people in the Napoleonic era. So, as you can see, it would have been much easier to camouflage a same-sex, romantic, and/or sexual relationship as one of these intense platonic friendships that were so common during this period. Still, despite the incremental progress towards full legal equality, the bottom line is, most queer people in Napoleonic Europe had to hide that part of themselves from the wider world. Only a very small number of them who were particularly lucky and bold were able to live semi-openly. Even with laws against homosexuality off the books, there were a lot of risks to being publicly known as a violator of the prevailing sexual mores. Most people could not afford to take those risks, or only did so very cautiously in secret. James Tremaine asked, I'm curious to know more about what bayonet fighting looked like. When a group of soldiers charged, would the opponents stand and also fight with the bayonet, or would they retreat? When charging, did soldiers stay together to form a wall of thrusting bayonets, like a Roman shield wall, or did they break apart and fight more individually? Were soldiers taught to turn aside or parry opponents' bayonet thrusts, and was there some kind of combat training beyond practicing thrusting? It's hard to generalize too much in answering questions like this. There are almost endless descriptions of Napoleonic-era combat. Hand-to-hand fighting occurred in all kinds of contexts. If you can imagine it, it probably happened at least somewhere, at least once. However, to answer the first part of your question, a real hand-to-hand bayonet melee was somewhat rare. There were two common results to a bayonet charge: the defenders fleeing, or the attackers losing their nerve, and the charge faltering before it closed the distance. A bayonet charge in which both sides had the heart to actually fight it out hand-to-hand was comparatively rare. Shooting at someone and stabbing someone with a bayonet are psychologically quite different. Most people, including soldiers, find the former much easier than the latter. I once read an account of French troops and Germans in British service from the King's German Legion fighting inside a house. There was a large dining room with a group of Germans at one end and Frenchmen at the other, desperately loading and firing their muskets at each other as fast as possible, knowing that it was hard to miss at such close range, and thus trying to get off more shots than the enemy. The men had their bayonets fixed, and there was not very much ground between the two groups. If one group had simply waited for the other to fire their shots, then charged, they would have certainly been able to close the distance before their enemies finished loading. But under the stress of battle, fighting hand-to-hand seems not to have occurred to anyone, and so they continued blasting away at each other as the room filled with smoke. I think that anecdote is a good illustration of the aversion Napoleonic soldiers had to fighting with the bayonet. Even when it is the smarter tactical choice, it seems more dangerous to get up close to the enemy and fight him face to face. The ability to get over this aversion is part of what set elite troops apart from other units. You might recall our discussion of the infantry of the Russian Imperial Guard from our episode on Austerlitz. This was part of their ethos, that not only were they willing to fight with the bayonet, they were eager for it. That willingness to face the enemy up close and press the charge home was part of what made them a powerful force. To get to the second part of your question, the bayonet is designed to be used in a group. You can test this out for yourself by executing a bayonet thrust. Stand at an angle with your left side towards the target, bend your knees slightly to get a little low, and then lunge forward, extending your left leg and pushing with your right leg as you extend your hands forward. You should end up with your feet quite far apart, your right leg fully extended, and left leg bent quite low. If you've ever seen the way Olympic fencers lunge, it is similar, except with both hands on the weapon, obviously. Lunging this way enables you to get maximum range and put the weight of your body behind the thrust. Remember, the goal here is to impale the enemy, not poke him. If you get into that position at the end of a lunge, or just imagine it, it is immediately obvious how vulnerable you are. You are very dangerous to anyone directly in front of you, but you are wide open from every other direction. With all your body weight forward, the only way you can really move is directly backwards, shifting your weight back to the center and dragging your left foot back to its original position. So making a big lunging attack like this is very risky. That is, unless you have comrades on either side of you, ready to skewer anyone who tries to take advantage of your overextension. As to the last part of your question, I have seen combat manuals from this era that describe bayonet fencing, if you can call it that. The proper way to parry an enemy's bayonet, and how to attack without being parried yourself. However, I have never read or seen depictions of mass bayonet drills in which this was actually being taught to soldiers. Bayonet drill seems to have been a pretty distant priority in infantry training. The really important combat skills for a Napoleonic infantryman were moving and fighting in formation, maintaining discipline under fire, and of course, loading and firing the musket. Bayonet fighting was comparatively rare, and it's not exactly complicated. The pointy part goes towards the enemy. End of story. Apparently, some armies of this period didn't train their men in the use of the bayonet at all, but simply taught them how to attach one to their muskets and assumed instinct would take care of the rest. The bottom line is, bayonet fighting was simply not as big a part of Napoleonic combat as you might expect. Bayonet charges were relatively common, but true infantry versus infantry melees were rare, and apparently fleeting. Dr. Dominique Jean Larry, the brilliant French army surgeon we've discussed in several past dispatches, estimated that only about 1% of battlefield wounds were caused by bayonets. That is on the low end of estimates. Other studies done at the time, and some by modern historians, have come up with higher numbers, but I've never seen an estimate higher than 2.5%. Granted, we do have to take that with a grain of salt. If bayonet wounds tended to be more lethal than those caused by musket fire or artillery, doctors would have seen less of them. But however you slice it, muskets and cannon clearly dominated the battlefield. The bayonet was a situational weapon. And it seems the threat of the bayonet played a bigger role in most engagements than actual bayonet combat. Next, Anastasia Montez asked, Napoleon's army has now marched east, and the Treaty of Tilsit saw the reintroduction of Poland on the world stage, as the Duchy of Warsaw. So what happened to the Polish soldiers that fought with Napoleon in Italy? Did they stay under Napoleon's command? Did they all return to the Duchy of Warsaw? In 1807, a large number of Polish troops from the French military were reassigned to the new army of the Grand Duchy of Warsaw. The duchy's new units were mostly composed of raw recruits and ex-insurgents who had fought in the Greater Poland Uprising, who had seen a little combat but didn't know much about formal soldiering. As we saw in our episodes on the levée en masse and amalgamation in the French army during the Revolution, even very eager and motivated new recruits needed a nucleus of veterans to keep them steady in combat and teach them the ropes. These veterans of the Polish Legion played that role in the new army of the Grand Duchy, and they are a big reason the Poles were one of the most reliable and effective of the foreign contingents provided by Napoleon's allies and vassal states. However, there were some Polish soldiers who stayed in French service after the formation of the Grand Duchy. The most famous of these were the men of the 1st Light Cavalry Lancers Regiment of the Imperial Guard, one of the most celebrated and deadly units in Napoleon's personal bodyguard, and perhaps the whole French army. Its officers and men were almost all Polish, and the unit is often referred to simply as the Polish Lancers. In the near future, we'll be talking about the Battle of Somosierra, at which Napoleon's Guards Lancers carried out one of the most legendary cavalry charges in history. That's all for now. I'll be back to you in about a week with another episode from the main narrative. As always, thanks for listening.